and now the conclusion of the middle class horror series with fangirl Jean. In this episode, we are going to talk about masculinity in horror movies.
Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Of like funhouse mirror of that seems just so outrageous, you actually see like a level of truth. And I think part of his approach, Craven's, was to, you know, to be outrageous so that he could say some things that were really salient. And I think he's more successful with it with like Scream than again, like,
yes.
Scream basically looked at what essentially was considered the target demographic for horror movies and said, you're the killers.
Right, because right? And again, like, first of all, I have to just say, and this isn't just Scream, this is pretty much all of these slasher movies that are supposed to be middle class. Those houses are crazy. I don't know, like, those houses are huge. Who, like...
I say that middle class, you know, when I talk about it, it is not about economics, it's about an ideal.
Yeah.
And because you depending on where you live in the country, you know, middle class could be up to $200,000 a year.
That is very true. When I watch House Hunters, sometimes I would very much like there to be an edition called House Hunters Reality Check, where the people who can get this giant house for like $100,000 or less, and they're just like, I don't like the paint in this bathroom, I don't want this house, come to Long Island and be like, so do you want to know what you can get for that here?
Right. Oh yeah, no, absolutely. It is, I mean, that, and that again is like a reflection of systems that are in place that are causing these problems.
Right.
And I think it is an interesting subtext, whether, you know, it's on purpose or not, of a lot of those movies that even Halloween, you know, that was being shot in a suburb of California. It was supposed to be, I think, somewhere on the East Coast is where it's supposed to be set, but it's a pretty affluent neighborhood.
Yeah, and Sydney's house is huge. It's huge. It is. But a few things about that movie. First of all, yeah, the guys who are, again, spoiler alert, it's been over 20 years. You should be okay with this. The bad guys are like these obnoxious twerps who are obsessed with all of these slasher movies and terrorizing women because they're like, oh, well, you're not a virgin anymore. It says you gotta die. Ha ha. Like, come on. Like, what is it? That whole meme, are we the baddies?
Yes. You are. Yes, you are. Yeah, I think that Craven, he found somewhat of a balance, especially in Scream, of being able to be kind of outrageous while also being horrific and being able to slide in these commentaries about like who are the real dangerous people and what, you know, this ideology. Is it Randy, the one who always lists the,
I feel like it,
the rules of how to survive?
I feel like it is Randy. I'm looking it up and I know like he does not make it through the whole franchise, but Heather Matarazzo plays his sister later.
Yeah. But spoilers again. But but like even his character, like while he's supposed to be like the approachable geeky guy, you know, insert for the audience, I still feel like there's a reflection there because he's absolutely buying into the ideology as a rule, as if he himself couldn't possibly, you know, like that idea of, well, I'm just as likely to be a victim, right?
Right.
But,
yeah.
But But are you, which is one of the reasons I just liked his character being killed, even, you know, even though I felt like it was just a reflection of like the writers didn't know what to do with him.
Right.
Because I felt like, you know, he's a great example of someone who buys into that mentality of like, if I follow the rules, then nothing's going to happen to me, as if rules are going to ever prevent somebody from being, you know, victim of violent crime, you know. But you know, systemic factors seem to reinforce that, right?
You know, so just because I want to go in this direction, you know, I talk about guys in horror movies. Because there's a lot of discourse about women in horror movies, and it's very obvious why. And, you know, like we talked about charisma with like Freddy, for instance, which is absolutely down to the actor who played him. I don't think that, you know, you were saying he really brought it on. You want to talk about someone who goes to 11, like went to 11.
Robert England is the king of it. Yeah, well, and I mean, I think we've seen proof of, you know, an equally charismatic actor took over that role and it just didn't resonate the same way. I actually, well, I don't necessarily, it's hard to say like, what I like aspects of the reboot. And because it, I don't know if you've seen it, it made a choice to make the sexual abuse aspect.
Right, which is what we were talking about before, that like basically they decided in the 80s that, you know, well, we'll just let him be a child killer because that's cool, I guess. Yeah, you know, we're not gonna put that sexual aspect. But originally he was supposed to be, you know, so they decided to put that into the reboot.
Yeah, and what I disliked was they kind of did this, you know, again, spoilers, they did like a double twist thing where the twist was the kids realizing, you know, at first thinking, you know, they discover that their parents killed this guy and they're thinking that they wrongfully killed him because they don't remember any abuse happening and they think that they're responsible because they made stuff up. And I was like, when I watched the movie, I was like, this is amazing. You know, like, you know, then that makes Freddy a manifestation of fear mongering, of this, you know, satanic panic. And then of course they pulled it back and, oh yes, no, he's really a terrible.
But really, I mean, which is a lot of those movies just about the satanic panic in general. You know, they do a lot of those double twists where it's like, you know, oh, but really it's not, but also Satan, hey, right. Still a thing, you know, like any movie about witches, it's like, well, you know, like women, the way they're looked at by society, but also witches, right. And this, Satan.
One of the reasons I really don't like The Witch is I'm like, you know, you said a lot of great things and then you know, shit the bed at the end. Sorry. I swear, but I did not like that ending. I didn't think it was feminist. I felt like it was like, oh. Okay.
There's a lot I could talk to about that. Let's talk about masculinity. Right. Because there is a lot of that. And in The People Under the Stairs, which I guess falls outside of your thread because your thread is mostly 70s and 80s, and that's very early 90s. But it brings it back because the family whose name is Robeson. So the Robesons, they're taking other children. They're exploiting the people who live on the properties in the urban cities. They're exploiting the Black people, the people, you know, poor people, mostly Black people, because we get into their world through Fool's eyes, and he's one of the people who's going to be evicted because they're terrible. But he's led around the house by Alice, who is played by the same actor AJ Langer as Rayanne from My So-Called Life. Yes. Very little, and she's wearing this white dress, and she's running around the house with him to avoid the people under the stairs, who you later find out are these boys who were stolen by the Robesons, and they like physically maimed them. And it's interesting to me that Alice is being treated as this little fragile doll and the boys are just being maimed. And you know, getting to masculinity, one of my favorite horror movies or favorite series, and possibly because as it went on, it got increasingly more ridiculous, was the Evil Dead series.
Yes.
I have a very weird relationship with the character of Ash, because in general, like, if I was to ever meet somebody like him, I'd be like, oh, just stop. But I enjoyed watching his evolution on screen. The first movie is very different. The second movie basically sums it up in, like, the first 10 minutes, instead of a whole group of friends at some cabin in the woods, it's just him and his girlfriend, and then mayhem ensues. And there's some Lovecraftian stuff in there too, right? Because it's the Necronomicon.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah, like, so talking about masculinity and horror, you know, Ash is actually a great example of a male character allowed in a series to go from a victim to a victor. And his personality says a lot, especially as it evolves, of what we think is the kind of guy who should be a lead in a horror series and one that is a victim in a horror series.
Does he evolve, or does he like de-evolve?
Well, okay, like I would say, you know, he got legs enough to be on land.
Yes.
Right, like, well, I think he transformed.
He does, standard,
you know, masculine, you know, victim in a horror movie to, you know, essentially a masculine ideal. Mm. And, okay, so interesting fact, another great YouTube channel too, Dead Meat. They do a series called Kill Count, which is just fun to watch. Like, if you don't want to rewatch an old movie, old horror movie that you love, just watch the kill count of it. And it's very funny, it's very clever. But one of the things it is, does an actual statistic roundup at the end of each episode. And a majority of the horror movies, at least that, so I can't say, you know, over the whole thing, of the history of horror, but the majority of victims in horror movies are men.
Mm, yeah.
Not women. Oh, the memorable ones, the ones we remember, are usually women, but majority of them are men, which then begs the question, like, well, why are we all upset about violence against women since it seems to be so many men dying in these movies? And I think what's interesting is, again, where, like I talked with the car, masculine anxiety manifests in these movies about the wrong type of men.
Yes.
Or men, you know, again, you know, or men's sexuality or sexual appetite leading them to being vulnerable.
Beautiful. Okay, so a few things. So in the first, I'm going to sort of put the first two movies together in my mind, because a lot of Ash's original trauma cycles around the fact that his girlfriend Linda, who he gives this necklace to, and I think, like, in both of the movies, the necklace has like this, the chain kind of is like shaped like a, when it's lying flat, the chain almost looks like a skull, which I thought was kind of fun, visual. But Linda dies, and he's so broken over it, which is not the Ash at all that we see in Army of Darkness. Now, thinking about Ash as a final boy, because we talked about final girls, thinking about Ash as a final boy, a lot of the whole final girl thing that people talk about is that they have like these gender non-specific names, like Sydney, I think is too meta to really talk about, but you know, like Lori, yeah, and I believe, I'm just trying to go back and think in, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like, I think they call her Stretch. It's something, you know.
Yeah,
it's not like, you know, to that point, a lot of people who have then taken the book that was written, Men, Women, and Chainsaws by Carol J. Clover, they'll build upon it and they'll be like, okay, I'm going to have a final girl in this movie. And her name is going to be Lauren, because Lauren was, you know, masculine in the past, or it'll be like Quinn, like something that can be, you know, can kind of transcend gender. But Ashley is his name, and that also fits. So he is the final boy of the people who go to the cabin. In the first movie, it's him and his friends. And then even with him and Linda, where they just make it the two of them in the beginning of the second one. And ultimately, at the end of the second movie, like, you have these people who have a strong connection to what's in the basement, which is the Necronomicon and these things that have been summoned. Mm-hmm. And he still lives beyond them. Talking about, you know, like, his evolution or his transformation, he has emotions in those first two movies. He's upset, he's sad, but Bruce Campbell is such a cartoon character in how he acts. Mm-hmm. Almost that when you get to Army of Darkness, there, you know, which is not considered the best of the franchise, but it's definitely the most quotable. He's flashing back to when he had to cut off his own arm, which I've heard argued is like a castration scene almost, and he's laughing in Army of Darkness, but if you go back and you watch that original movie, he's like screaming in agony.
I mean, a lot of people have talked about, you know, the criticisms of, you know, of Men, Women, and Chainsaws and the idea of the final girl. So I'm not going to necessarily retread all that. What I'll say is that, like I was saying before about victim blaming and slut shaming, I think it comes out of these distorted ideas of what is safe and what's not safe and what are good choices and bad choices. Again, this idea of if I know, I'm in control, and that makes us feel safe. And masculinity within these situations and dealing with violence is exactly the same way of like, you know, much like Randy, you know, these are the things, but we never, those ideas of like, you know, the things that'll get you killed in a horror movie, we don't like, we go, oh, it's a moral thing. We don't dig deeper about the ideas of beyond morality. We really think that that we take these ideas of especially like crime statistics and say, well, if you do these things, like you get drunk and you go out, you know, you're gonna get in trouble, or if you do drugs, you're gonna get, you know, involved in violence. Look at the statistics, except that we don't look at who is actually like disproportionately actually victims of this stuff. Like, you know, if you only ever showed somebody popular Western horror movies from the 70s and the 80s, they will tell you that what young white women are probably the most threatened demographic, you know, the most victimized of murder. And it's not in those eras, it was young Black men. Mm-hmm. And so again, we're distorting reality because we want it to fit this idea of that we have control and that we have an ability to be a person who's not a victim. And that definitely comes from the ideas of masculinity. Well, if you don't do this, you don't do that, then you're not going to be, you know, if you're a strong man, if you're a tough guy, and if you do what you got to do, then you're fine. You're not going to be bullied. You're not going to be victimized. And you see that kind of mentality happen and take place when you look at who is victimized as far as masculine people in these movies, who are the ones that are putting themselves at risk, I say air quotes, you know, and, you know, obviously drugs and alcohol, but chasing women, absolutely. Right. Which I think is fascinating that we don't look at that as a form of slut shaming for men,
right,
at all, which is, yeah, like, why are we, it's not, because what it is saying that proximity to women makes you vulnerable. And here's the really fascinating aspect of the transformation that Ash goes through from being a deeply emotionally vulnerable man who cares about a woman to a completely, like, almost cartoonishly, you know, user of women, you know, and how that lines up with the ideals of superheroes.
Oh, yes.
Who can't get close to anybody because it's for their own safety. And, you know, and that masculinity, that James Bond ideal, because that's the exact same arc that James Bond goes through of his one great love dying, therefore he can never commit to women
again. Right.
Yeah. And that is the idea of that emotions and, you know, true deep emotions make a man vulnerable to being hurt. Therefore, it you know, it comes out in a lot of these tropes of, you know, Peter Parker breaking up with Mary Jane to protect her.
Right.
Like, yeah, anybody who gets close to me is, you know, which I hate because it you know, it's as if soldiers and you know, firefighters and police officers don't actually have relationships, which is false. They all do. And those stories of what it's like to be a family member of someone who, you know, risks their lives and that's an interesting story, but we don't really get that because we can't comprehend a man who's in a relationship. He has a vulnerability. Again, that's a form of objectification of women and children, of that they are a thing that makes men vulnerable. And that is absolutely an aspect of how men and women or women and children are viewed in horror as vulnerable.
Yeah.
And causing stress, you know, Poltergeist, great example of how women and children make a man who is a Reagan, literally reading a biography of Reagan in like the first part of a movie, makes this guy vulnerable. When in actuality, it's actually Reagan economic greed that made his whole family vulnerable.
Right.
So masculinity and horror, I think, is fascinating because you can go through and look at the victims and you can see each time what thing about those guys made them not men. And you know, be it that they are fat, be it that they are conventionally unattractive but still trying to scam on women, can't dance, or whatever, you know, like those typically and so it is, like we were talking before, it's not surprising that Freddie becomes so popular, or even Jason and Michael Myers for their stoic, silent, unrelenting strength kind of ideal and become the protagonists of a series, despite the fact that they are murderers. So I think what the question when it comes to, you know, why do we find these men appealing, I talked about before, is like, look at what the heroes in our stories look like, because they look really similar to who the villains are, which isn't necessarily, I mean, there's commentary there, but I don't think we necessarily get that close. And again, about like masculinity and horror. So like a good example of how horror can raise the stakes, especially with masculine protagonists. Pitch Black is a movie. I would argue is one of the best sci-fi horror movies out there. And one of the things that it does that I think gives us a really great example of the difference between feminine and masculine vulnerability is the difference between how the pilot, she exists in a constant state of anxiety from the minute the crash happens. We travel with her through the intense vulnerability through the whole movie. While Riddick's character, it seems to always be cool and in control and almost exists as a slasher murderer antagonist character for a good portion of the beginning of the film.
Carolyn Fry is the main character. Played by Radha Mitchell.
Yes, she's awesome. Yes. So we see her, she's in a constant, unquestionable state of vulnerability and even feeling threatened from the other people around her, you know, knowing that, so she's not only fearing for the fact that they're crashed on an alien planet that they don't know. There's possibly monsters after them, but also she's in fear of the fact of the passengers finding out that she tried to dump them all. So she's in this constant state of anxiety and vulnerable. And then we have Riddick, who is strong, in control. Even when he's tied up, he's in control. We see him, you know, like I said, we get the voyeuristic where we get to see through his point of view. And then they introduce the monsters. And what I think is, you'll see this, Predator is another good example of this, where the storytelling tool of making your monsters even scarier is by making them, putting a 100% stereotypical, strong, in control man in the situation and show that he's outgunned by your monster.
And one thing I love just in general is that Riddick is played by Vin Diesel, who voices these gentle giants of characters like Groot and the Iron Giant, which, mm-hmm. you know, the two of those two characters, in a way, they seem kindred to each other because they are big and can be destructive but are also protective. And he's also like, he's a huge fan of Dungeons and Dragons and all this stuff that we were told in the 80s was not cool or was evil. So finding out, you know, that about Riddick, who is this caricature and everything you were talking about, and then being like, but this is Vin Diesel, was always kind of fun to me.
Oh yeah. I mean, like, I think one of the great things about Vin Diesel being so open and out there about his, you know, geekiness and like even having, I believe he has a tattoo of his D&D character's
name. He does, I believe.
Is because he's not only, he's undoing that mythos that was reinforced in the 80s of the division between jocks and geeks, of this idea that these men can never, these streams can never cross, and there's no, and which is complete BS, and we know that. So I do think that, you know, and I think he brings like an insight of that to his work. I mean, one thing I like about a lot of the stuff he does is that he's not feigning pretension. He goes into different projects based solely on like, I want to see a B movie about that. Oh, look, he's not going to pretend he's not in a B movie about witches. He's just going to, you know, bring 150% and just be totally in it. I'm fine. You know, cars and space. Yes, let's do it. You know, so I have that affection, but I think he definitely brought an aspect to Riddick that, you know, in that first movie. The other ones are weird. but he brought an aspect of showing a kind of vulnerability that was allowed to be strong, but also, you know, vulnerable, especially towards the end. But, you know, in the first take you go through the movie, you're not sure through whether he's on their side or not, all the way up into the end. And so, again, I think that is the way that a male character can survive those movies, is being a tough guy.
And
easily be a villain as the hero. And that is Ash, 100%. He is out for himself. He's going to go across everybody to get what he wants, which is fascinating. Like, why is that the guy that's the hero?
Well, that's the question, because the world that he's kind of dropped into in that last movie is like, I think it's like it's almost Arthurian. I mean, I don't know if they specifically say that the king is Arthur Pendragon, but he's definitely a stand-in. And the first thing he does is like shoot Excalibur in half. And he's like, hello, Mr. Fancy Pants. So it's like, you've got like this romantic vision of masculinity, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. And then you've got this crazy cartoonish, like comical, but ideal masculinity of that time. And
Well, and I feel like, you know, again, I like, you know, he seems outrageous, but he's not, you know, I mean, because you can see parallels of him, especially in, you know, 80s and 90s of that guy. And especially, you know, people talk about like the rise of the geek or the rise of the slacker types. And I definitely feel like that Ash was a precursor of that. Mm-hmm. Because what he's representing is not just like, you know, the Superman, you know, fists on my hip, I'm here to save the day type of masculinity. He's representing a jaded, I don't get with this PC culture type of, again, quote unquote, type of stuff, which absolutely epitomizes the type of masculinity that really rose in the late 90s and the early aughts, where yeah. we got into Judd Apatow.
Judd Apatow, fun fact, is one of our past guests. He went to Syosset High School. Yes.
Oh, awesome. Yes. Yeah, well, and like, I think he, like, because he worked on Freaks and Geeks.
Freaks and Geeks is very, there are parts of Freaks and Geeks that are directly based on people in my high school. Judd Apatow's mentor, Jack DeMasi, I took his classes. He's been a guest a few times. He's actually a really cool guy.
I think we see in his work you know, a humanizing of that experience of the geek, you know, but also like of freaks, because I think of geeks and the slacker as the two aspects of a similar type of ethos in adolescence of, you know, either the kids that try hard or mm-hmm. the kids that just don't want to bother. And I, as someone who skated between those, because being on the spectrum, I either was a genius or I was behind in special needs, quote unquote. I see that type of, you know, this is a rise of that type of masculinity that may not necessarily be strong, may not necessarily even be necessarily that intelligent or, you know, a high achieving, but is savvy. And that, I feel like Ash is savvy.
He's so savvy.
He's over it. He knows better than yeah. everybody. And it's yeah. like that, like you said, like if I met that dude in real life, I would be done with him in 5 minutes.
Well, I mean, like that's like the woman who's talking to him at the end of Army of Darkness, when he's like, well, you know, in a way I am king here. And she's just like, ah, dude, just stop talking. But at the end of the movie, that's like totally it. You know, he's like bested his alternate self, okay, mm-hmm. which is like somehow even worse than the Ash that we get. And he's like bested King Arthur and I think it was Henry the Red and Merlin. They're all just like, okay, fine, you can be the hero, dude, you know, and we'll send you back. Just make sure you say the words the right way and the incantation to send you back. But like when he's back in the real world, generally people are staring at him like, just stop and tell me where my stuff is, because he's working in S-Mart, like a
right,
you know. But then a deadite comes out, or a zombie for those who aren't as savvy, and he's back to being king.
And that's a fantasy right there. That is absolutely fantasy, that like I wouldn't be successful. I'm not successful because I work at Walmart in real life. But if I was transported back to a medieval world overrun with zombies, I would be the king. And I talked about this a bit on a different podcast, talking about Guardians of the Galaxy, but I definitely feel like this idea of the savvy but kind of doesn't care slacker hero definitely emerged from, again, from that same era of like the 70s, and specifically a kind of post-Vietnam experience of masculinity. And, you know, I kind of summarize it up with like Han Solo. And, you know, I love Han Solo, but in real, like in our world, he would be Matthew McConaughey in Dazed and Confused. He would be the older dude hanging out with the high school kids.
Yeah.
Dating a 19-year-old.
All right. I always like, oh man. I have a lot of thoughts about Han Solo as well, but
I hear what you're saying. Yeah. Masculinity that exists in that, again, yeah. Like I'm just, you know, you mean, and to loop it back to Judd Apatow's work is that, again, those houses are really nice, but that yeah. is still a middle-class mentality of here I am in my 40s, you know, mm-hmm. here me and my friends, and I'm not the cool guy I thought I was going to be when I was 40. And it's, you know, of course it's not horror, but it is a kind of anxiety being manifested of why didn't I fall down a wormhole into a medieval world where I could, you know, wow them with my yo-yo master skills.
Which is literally, by the way, the plot of the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, right? That these geeks and like their little brother and, you know, and like, I'm glad that there were some women in there, you know, because like you're talking, that it was another thing about Dungeons and Dragons, everybody but apparently Jack Chick, who wrote a tract about women playing Dungeons and Dragons and summoning demons, everybody seemed, was like, women don't play Dungeons and Dragons. So somebody who wrote truly awful things wrote something about women playing Dungeons and Dragons, and then the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon had women in it. But that was it. Like, they went on a ride and they were dropped into like the world of Dungeons and Dragons where they got to be the heroes.
Yeah, well, and you know, that fantasy, like, I think that, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, I think I can still count it as mid-40s. I'm part of that generation that grew up on things like the Goonies. Like, we've had that fantasy forever of, you know, that adventure, you know, never-ending story. Adventure is right around the corner, and we could just any moment drop into a world where we're way more capable of handling this than adults. And then those kids became adults. And, you know, that mentality of, like, I got it all figured out. And that's why I'm also not impressed by anything, and why I think we have this this idea that it's, you know, that this isn't misogynistic, because, well, I like women and they're there and we're cool, but it's, again, it's not analyzing what, you know, what anxieties are driving us where we are, because, you know, if you're not if men are still not feeling comfortable being vulnerable, which horror reflects that, and it's definitely still really popular, then they're not really doing the work that's going to help out, you know, women as well. And I think you look at modern horror, we look at the anxieties that a lot of people, you know, talk about, look, you know, like It Follows is, you know, reflecting anxieties around STIs and whatnot. And I think, yes, but I think it's, again, about like this unknown vulnerability.
Yeah.
And through human connection, I think there's a lot of horror and just a lot of stories in general that come down to, like, you know, seem like they're about sex or about physicality, which really about fears of connecting with other people and being vulnerable by having, you know, connections with other people, which is absolutely, I think, an aspect of how masculinity is represented in horror, of, you know, of how often is the loner. I mean, that's another trope that's connected to that type of, you know, not traditionally physically strong, not honorable men of the people, but very much like, I'm the lone Logan Wolverine, you know.
Oh yeah, that guy. See, and I was thinking about Cabin in the Woods, which is another parody where, yeah, like, literally, like the hero is the stoner who's not affected by everything because he's stoned 24/7, right? Like, I think,
yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even say he's necessarily a hero. I think I would say he's a final boy to some extent.
Yeah, yeah.
But even then, not necessarily, because, you know, spoilers. But
he stumbles around and he seems to make it work.
Yeah, well, and what I think, you know, one of the, like, I both love and have issues with Cabin in the Woods, because I think it both is trying to comment on something while also replicating it, and it's really,
that's so Joss Whedon,
right. I'm like, you know, great that you have an opinion about people objectifying women, but you're still just exactly doing that,
right.
So I'm
yeah.
not really sure what we're trying to say here.
Yeah.
And for me, like the structure of like the subtext of the world happening in that, I felt like it didn't have a lot of like, it was just like, you know, thrown together. Well, we have to do this because, and I feel like that is such a great like embodiment of how I often see how men are putting together a puzzle in the dark. Like they can feel the edges of what patriarchy is. And so they can put it together and they can see, you know, but they can't actually see the picture that's on there. And so they may make wonderful connections about things. Like I feel like James Cameron's Terminator movies, and specifically 1, 2, and then Dark Fate mm-hmm. are an amazing like thesis on womanhood and motherhood and about yeah. how like, because I'm sorry, John Connor fans, but he is not the lead of that show. No. He is the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
And
literally he really is.
Literally is the MacGuffin. Absolutely. And really the leader of that saves humanity is Sarah Connor.
Yeah. Because
he wouldn't be who he was if he had been trained by her. And that's right. You know, one of the things I think that was beautiful that came out of Dark Fate was like, yes, if we could have done that a little bit better, that is the perfect, you know, ending of her arc as a character. But again, like, I feel like I don't think that was the intention. I think it just resulted from like, well, let's do this differently and let's do this differently. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like, you know, Cabin in the Woods, and I think, you know, like we talked about with victim blaming and slut shaming, is that we have these pieces that seem to make sense to us as we put them together or as men put them together, but they're not seeing all the aspects of the pieces. They're only just seeing the outlines of it.
Right.
And so it may resonate with women. Men exist in the same world we do, and they see. Yeah. And so I do feel like I want to give credit for that. Like, especially Wes Craven towards mm-hmm. the end of his life, he really was reflective about how, like, he even said the words "so many dead girls." Like he mm-hmm. was very aware of the impact his work had, and I feel like Scream was really him trying to kind of counteract that and to create that conversation. So I want to say that like it is valid to feel a relationship with Final Girls, to feel an understanding and feel represented by the horror movies and horror tropes, while them still reinforcing yeah. really terrible things because
for sure. yeah.
of how we're, you know, thinking about this stuff and how we relate to vulnerability, especially because our fears are deeply connected to when we feel vulnerable, when we feel out of place. And that means we need to deconstruct what we think safety is
mm-hmm.
and whether our safety is coming at the expense of other people.
Beautifully put. So I understand you're still updating the middle class horror thread.
Yes. Yes.
We are going to put a link to your Twitter in the show notes. We're going to do it. Actually, we have done it with each installment of this episode, because this has been a multi-part episode, and it's been wonderful having you here. You've been so much fun to talk to. So I will be following along with that, but please, listeners, if any of this tickled your fancy, please check Fangirl Jean out. I found this fascinating and amazing. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This was wonderful.
Well, come back at some point.
Absolutely. We'll do this again.
Okay. We are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
Thank you for joining us for the Middle Class Horror series with Fangirl Jean. Please check out Jean's original thread on Twitter at Fangirl Jean, JEANNE. Happy summer scares, and we hope that you've enjoyed listening to this as much as we enjoyed recording it.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.